I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Fear is a constant presence in America's cities, now filled with surveillance cameras, bomb-sniffing dogs, and metal detectors. But are our fears warranted? Dr. Mark Siegel says it's a false alarm. That's the title of his new book, and in it he challenges what he calls our epidemic of fear. Dr. Mark Siegel is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us is Harriet Tregoning. As director of the Smart Growth Leadership Institute, Harriet will lead the recently announced Governor's Institute on Community Design, a new program of the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll return to Smart City right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Dr. Mark Siegel is a practicing internist, an associate professor at the New York University School of Medicine, and a fellow in the Master Scholar Society at New York University. And he is author of False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. Dr. Siegel, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure, Carol.
We have our bags searched at the airport. Students go through metal detectors to get to their classrooms. Bomb squad dogs are a daily presence in subways. And cameras now follow us on the street. Everywhere we go, we're confronted with signals that tell us we ought to be afraid. Should we be afraid?
Well, no, we shouldn't be afraid, because the risk to the individual in any of the situations that you just described remains very, very low. The concern that I have is that we're sending signals with that type of scrutiny that something is in the offing, which it isn't. I'm all for being prepared, and I'm all for any kind of safety net that's out there. There's no way you can be against that. But a different issue that I'm looking at in my book is, what signals are we sending to people with this type of activity? And I believe what we do is we rev up the fear mechanism. People get a sense that something's about to happen. They get stressed, and stress hormones run through the body, which is not good from a health point of view.
Well, what toll is this unnecessary fear taking on our physical health and our mental health?
Well, our mental health, I think, is the first thing. We have this obsession in this country right now with something happening, which is actually out of proportion to the statistical risk. I like to say that we're doing the terrorists' job for them. I mean, terrorism is bad. Bombs are very bad, but the real tool of the terrorist is fear. And if a small event occurs and it gets broadcast throughout the country and everybody thinks it's going to happen to them, then we've done the terrorist work for them. We're a voyeuristic society, so we plug into our media and we think it's going to happen to us. What then happens is you get a buildup of adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol. These hormones over time put you at risk for obesity, for smoking if you're a smoker, for heart disease, for certain kinds of cancer, certainly for depression, and for stroke. And more studies are showing a correlation between what I would call chronic fear and maybe a societal anxiety. It's as opposed to the illness anxiety, I think we're becoming a scared society.
Can fear, though, serve a positive purpose? I mean, certainly there is a rationale for fear in certain situations, and it has a positive purpose.
Fear is meant to protect us. We inherit it from our animal forebears. It's centered in an organ in the brain known as the amygdala. It's the emotional center of the brain. That same center also processes positive emotions like passion, love, courage. So, in fact, one of the antidotes for fear is to try to replace the negative emotions with the positive ones. But fear is supposed to be a warning system. It's supposed to say, you know, some big hairy gorilla is looming over you. I mean, the animals understand that. They don't trigger their fear mechanisms because they hear that 1,000 miles away, a gorilla is taking its first step towards you. I think that's the difference. Carol, we have the ability to risk assess. We can be logical. We can use the upper centers of our brain to tell us information. But if we give the wrong information, we alert our emotions. And once turned on, it's hard to turn off.
We've talked about the category of things that revolve around responses to terrorism. What else fits in the category of things we are worried about but really shouldn't be?
Well, you know, I like to think that it's all related. Terrorism is a big one because it's gotten a lot of attention, and we all kind of understand what it is. But in a way, there is many issues that we look at daily in terms of, is this a threat to us? Isn't it a threat to us? And our system for assessing that has gone haywire. Cancer, we're afraid of. I call cancer the medical terrorist. You know, my patients all think they're going to get cancer. If I do an x-ray, do I have cancer? You know, a CAT scan signals cancer. So that's the that's the healthcare terrorist. We've started to feel that way about our prescription drugs. Now, I'm one of those that's very critical of medications and the way that they're handled by our drug companies. But, you know, we in some sense are swinging the other way now. Just because a medication wasn't put on the market properly or it was rushed onto the market doesn't automatically mean it's going to kill you. So if you read a report that Vioxx say it increases your risk of heart disease, it doesn't mean that somebody that took one pill 5 years ago is going to increase their risk. The one thing, ironically, Carol, actually there's many things, but one thing that is a real killer that we think is actually very pleasant is the automobile. I mean, the automobile has a radio, it has an air conditioner, we make it look as comfortable as possible. In the meantime, 50 million people worldwide every year get injured in an automobile. That's what we ought to be afraid of.
How did this happen? How did the risk assessment measures go haywire? How did the pictures of missing children get posted on milk cartons and the elevators of the National Endowment for the Arts? And how did the topic become nightly fodder for Larry King?
You know, it's easy for me to blame the mainstream media, and they certainly are not blameless because they're the messenger and they have a big, big megaphone. But I also look very carefully in my book at who it is that's informing them. I mean, I think that our officials, well, maybe they want votes, but they're certainly not differentiating carefully between potential and actual risk. I mean, we seem to get a lot of play out of things that can get an effect on the public, and that's what promotes fear. We don't care about malaria, which is the worst disease in the world, but it's not here. And AIDS, we've kind of forgotten about, even though it's a true epidemic, not a potential one. And then we haul out potential epidemics, like bird flu, and we talk about them incessantly to show that we're doing something. So that, I mean, the media picks up that message and travels with it, but it's also our public health officials and our leaders that are responsible.
You deliver this message very compellingly in your book, False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. You're not the first person. Barry Glasner made some of the same points several years ago in what I thought was a wonderful book, The Culture of Fear. But, Dr. Siegel, nothing changed. I mean, in fact, the situation has grown much worse. So how can people be moved to sort through what they ought to be worried about and what they ought not to be worried about?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up Barry Glasner because I look at his book in my book and he did a wonderful job in his book. The two differences, and I think they're relevant to the answer to the question, is, first of all, I look at fear from a physiological point of view as a physician. And so it's not just a sociological argument. I want people to understand what fear is and that it's supposed to be working in a normal human body for protection purposes, and then how it goes haywire. I mean, people can understand that their heart rate is not supposed to be double normal. So if I attach fear to its physiological response, I think people will understand it better. And then the other comparison with Barry's book is that, of course, his book was written in the pre-9/11 era. And I think that what September 11th did was, though it was a horrible event and certainly the worst thing that's happened on our soil, you know, since Pearl Harbor. It's the first time we've been attacked since the War of 1812 on our continent. But, you know, the reaction to it was so extreme that I think it set in place a tremendous societal vulnerability. And the more we feel susceptible, the more we're going to feel that we can be overcome by imminent danger. And that's where we lose our way. So that's why I think things have gotten so much worse since the world that Barry Glasner wrote about so effectively.
And yet you both come to the same conclusion that we fear the wrong things. Our fears are outsized compared to the real threat. And my question is, there was certainly no movement, as you point out, acceleration after his book, and I'm wondering how you see the arguments you've put forth in your book really changing things. Do you see a path toward reversing this trend?
Well, you know, Barry talks about misdirection, where the media likes to put out there the sexy thing. You know, he talks a lot about, and the Columbine killings are related to this. You know, strangers are the people we fear because they're the ones that are going to get us in our dreams, when in reality, the real criminals most of the time is somebody that we know, an uncle, you know. And that's a very hard thing to change. The media has to get to the roots to change that. What I think can change from my book is, I don't think public health officials are meaning to scare people. I think they think they're doing a service. And I want to get this message out there that, you know, $6 billion for BioShield may not be a service if you stockpile anthrax vaccine and there's no anthrax. I think that the public health officials that are speaking on these things are very smart, and they can be redirected to scare people less. So that's actually my domain, is public health. But, you know, as you pointed out, this message is a problem with the way that the media also conveys information. That's a basic problem that hasn't changed and is very fundamental.
And, Dr. Siegel, are public health officials driving this message, in your opinion, or is it really a different driver, Homeland Security or someone really not, and the public health implications are just secondary to the big fear?
Who is driving this fear is a very important question, because I think, you know, I'm kind of identifying the media as a messenger, though the media has its own incentives for wanting an interesting story and not caring if it's a scary story. Public health officials think they're giving the right message, but they're being reinforced for that message by our leaders. And I think that people in office know they get more votes if they act like they're doing something. And the tragedy here is that the things they may be talking about or are talking about are not necessarily the things that have our health at risk. BioShield is a great example of that. You know, $6 billion go to a project where antibiotics are stockpiled and vaccines are stockpiled. These are perishable. Nobody bothers to tell you that if you don't use those antibiotics in 2 years, you have to throw them away. We make a bird flu vaccine. We don't know if there's any chance of a mutation. And we already have 2 million doses of this. We're taking resources away from our vaccine makers to make the regular flu vaccine. If there ever were a mutation, the vaccine might very well not work. So I'm concerned that our leaders are reinforcing a situation. This comes from Congress, it comes from the president, and the mandate is to be dealing with potential health threats rather than what really is our health threats, things like obesity and cancer and heart disease. These are the epidemics in our country. So the epidemic of fear takes the place of the true epidemics of disease, and our fears are stoked to get us interested in paying tax dollars for things that are really only potential threats.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Mark Siegel. He's written a new book, False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. You are critical of elected officials and administrators who promote fear. I don't disagree with you, but certainly we would be critical if the administration again missed the next set of clues to the next serious and real threat.
Well, you know, Carol, we all have to do our jobs, and we all have to be responsible people and have morals. So you're absolutely right. I think that one of the reasons that this occurs is because, you know, whoever is holding the flag doesn't want to be caught napping if something actually did occur. So you raise the alert, and just in case something occurred, you want to be the one that said it was going to occur. But it's enough of that already. I mean, which is worse, that somebody gets voted out of office or that the whole society gets unnecessarily afraid? I mean, I think the answer is that somebody in office wants to stay in office, but I think we need a more realistic rendering, because otherwise, in the long run, it's going to be something that we're going to laugh at. I mean, a lot of fun has been made of these orange alerts. It doesn't make the people that were raising the alert look particularly savvy. So we need a safety net, but what is our safety net against? The message for terrorism should be it's a terrible crime, but in most cases does not affect a mass number of individuals. In my book, I try to look at the difference. You know, we always call everything weapons of mass destruction. We apply it to everything. Now, we all know the elephant in the room is nuclear terror. So we just take that term and we apply it to sarin gas and anthrax and, you know, practically anything you can think of. But, I mean, look, a truck bomb is not a weapon of mass destruction. And even if chemical weapons were used or biological weapons, the chances are great that they would only affect a small number of people, because in delivering them, they would malfunction in some way. Wind would blow them away. They would be destroyed on impact. They would be observed. It's very hard to get any of these weapons to affect a mass number of people. It could, but that's the worst case scenario. So what I'm always saying is that we're worst case scenarioing all the time. And the public gets the message always, well, it's going to be this and it's going to destroy all these people. That's the worst case scenario. And in most cases, that wouldn't happen.
Every time I walk through an airport, I try to do a quick calculation of the public money being spent or the fees being spent on security. And it just appears to be enormous. And you mentioned earlier the cost effectiveness of the expenditures to deal with the threats that we've blown out of proportion to our daily lives. Do you think if we made a better, clearer calculation of the money we're spending and the value we're getting for that money being spent, as you point out, for instance, with BioShield vaccines, antibiotics that last only 2 years, do you think the American public would be more responsive and perhaps demand a different response?
Well, that's, of course, where the media comes in. I mean, I've been letting the media off the hook a little bit here, but if the media keeps pounding that message, then the Congress is going to vote more dollars for it. It's a double-headed beast or a triple-headed beast, and I think it feeds itself. And clearly, that's a big issue. If it became more public knowledge, the waste of resources and, people were voting on that basis more, I think that it might actually change something. You talk about airports. I mean, people don't even realize that there's been less deaths on planes over the past 50 years than there is in a car accident in a single year. People don't realize that statistic. And, it's gotten a lot of high profiling about the risk of terrorists attacking us by planes. And, of course, I'm not one to say that that isn't the major risk. But, of course, there's a lot of other ways that terrorists could hit us. And what we're doing is promoting a great fear of flying, which, again, costs a lot more resources to either defend against or to perpetuate.
You are a frequent contributor to the Today Show, Fox News, ABC. So you have a platform. You have a media platform. I'm wondering what you think it would take to amplify the other side, a more reasonable response to fear. What do you think we could do to amplify that message through the media?
Well, I take some hope with the fact that the media puts me on in that sense, because they, I think that the media is looking for perspective. And a lot of times when these threats occur, I go on and others go on talking about how people shouldn't panic. And of course, my message is similar to what I'm saying now, which is that the risk to the individual is always very, very low, and we can't just plug in voyeuristically to the latest message. And I don't have a sense that the media is saying, okay, let's haul out 10 scare guys and then just one seagull to show that there's another side to it. I don't get that feeling. But, you're right that there has to be more of a perspective. The media needs to adjust how it delivers the message. And one of the reasons this has happened is because of cable TV. Cable TV with 24-hour news, I mean, you can come on any time of day and night and hear the same horrible or threatening news. So one thing the public, of course, can do is not watch so much TV. I mean, you've got to avoid, I think, if you're a citizen, obsessing on this message.
You've written your book, False Alarm. What do you see as the next steps in getting the discussion seriously underway about how we reasonably respond to what really threatens us?
That's a great question. I see two areas that need a lot of work. One is that we need to drive this argument down the health perspective. I want to see more studies on fear physiologically and how it causes disease, because that's going to really make people take notice. If one of these studies in the media says, those people that were afraid of X ended up with heart disease 10 years later, people are going to take it very seriously. And I know the hormones exist, and I see the preliminary studies. We need large-scale studies that show that fear is a disease, and that fear is infectious, and that when you catch it, it causes a risk of more fundamental diseases like cancer and depression and stroke. The other major reform I think that needs to occur is what I call the media memory. I'd like to see the mainstream media, get some more corrections out there. I mean, there's a correction page on all major newspapers, and the Washington Post and the New York Times, for example, take those correction pages very, very seriously. But there's never any front page correction. And I think, there needs to be more accounting. There's only, let's move on to the next scare. Let's move on to the next danger. I'd like to see some headline that says in 2004, you know, front page, we're sorry, it turns out that SARS is not as easy to get as we thought. You know, I mean, we thought the whole country was going to get this disease, and we shut down all of Asia, and maybe we were right to do so, but in studying it in the laboratory, we find out it's actually a hard bug to get. If that kind of media correction occurred, then we wouldn't immediately sweep to the next health threat as though the last one was something that we defended against properly.
Dr. Mark Siegel, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure, Carol. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Mark Siegel is author of False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about panhandling and new attempts by mayors to stop it. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Harriet Tregoning, who directs the Smart Growth Leadership Institute, about a new program she will run for the National Endowment for the Arts, the Governor's Institute on Community Design. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, there are a number of cities where mayors are getting tough on panhandling, and those cities include Atlanta and Denver. What's happening there?
Yeah, it's actually even more than that. Dallas, San Francisco. We're just about at the end of our patience with panhandlers. The reason for it is they're bad for downtowns. They're bad for business downtown. They're bad for tourism downtown. People feel very uncomfortable when they're approached by strangers on the street who ask them for money. And mayors, understanding and appreciating the delicacy of all of this, have tried to sidestep it, and they're confronting it now. What's interesting in Denver these days is that they've done a survey of Denver residents. They're trying to find out how much money goes to panhandling in the city of Denver, and they found that more than 40% of city residents say they actually give money to people who beg, and that the average annual amount that people hand out, these 42%, is about $25 a year. It doesn't sound like much, but when you multiply that by all the people who say they give, it comes out to $4.6 million a year that people are giving out to folks standing on the street corners with their hands out. And Denver's leaders are shocked for a couple of reasons. One, it is that panhandling is a lot bigger business than anyone had thought of it, if you can think of it as a business. It is also, they say, a terrible way of helping the poor. $4.6 million a year given to organized charities could make an appreciable difference there. And then there's the other thing, which is the realization that the homeless and people who panhandle are not the same thing. There are many more homeless people than there are people who panhandle. And some of the panhandlers are not themselves homeless. So for a whole lot of reasons, it's not a good thing for panhandling to be encouraged in a city, for certainly. And the problem is nobody's figured out a way to humanely discourage it. They've tried some draconian things. They've tried some easy things. Nothing yet has been proven to work. But clearly cities are reaching the end of their patience.
Have you noticed that panhandlers in different cities have very different cultures or behaviors? I spend a lot of time, as you know, in Chicago, and panhandlers there are very docile. They simply sit on the street. They have a sign. If you want to give them money, they're happy to receive it. In Memphis, they're like greeters. They will follow you down the street if it's raining. They'll provide an umbrella. They'll give you directions. They'll walk you to your destination, never asking you for money until they've provided the favor.
There's probably a great book to be written about how the homeless reflect the culture of the city that they're in. Some cities are more attuned to hospitality than others, and Memphis is certainly one of those places which over the years has had a tradition of making outsiders feel at home. Other places are not so used to it.
Well, I think you've come up with a fascinating concept, Otis. We should do a book. Go around, study the panhandlers in various cities, and see what that tells us about those cities and their cultures. I love it.
There we are.
Okay, I'll talk to you next week if we have time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Harriet Tregoning is Executive Director of the Smart Growth Leadership Institute. She served as Special Secretary of the Maryland Office of Smart Growth under Governor Paris Clendenning. Much of her efforts there were directed at assisting local governments with implementation of smart growth policies, regulations, and procedures. She also served as Director of Urban and Economic Development for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where she co-founded the National Smart Growth Network. Harriet, what drives the way our communities develop today?
A lot of what dictates how our communities grow is really based on rules and regulations that were established shortly after World War II. So in some ways, we're working off a blueprint that's more than half a century old at this point and built very much for sort of an Ozzie and Harriet America, and we really look and live very differently than we did in 1950. So those rules and regulations are literally the rules of the game for most of the development that takes place in this country. And that means that if a place like Charleston, South Carolina, were to have to be rebuilt for some reason, the current rules and regulations wouldn't even allow you to rebuild the existing urban fabric.
What is it about the old rules and regulations that no longer work?
Increasingly, these rules and regulations have given over so much of our built environment to favor the automobile at the expense of pedestrians, at the expense of small businesses, at the expense of people who might want to take transit or ride a bicycle. And so, you know, a lot of what used to be our main streets are now pretty much uncrossable arterials or thoroughfares that really divide communities and prevent people from really meeting their daily needs without having to get in the car themselves.
You say at the expense of. Is it possible to serve both interests, both automobile and pedestrians, for instance?
Absolutely. I think that none of us really envision a world where we wouldn't have access to an automobile, but I think many people would really like to have the choice of being able to walk down the street to a park or to pick up a quart of milk or to buy an ice cream cone. And there's so many ways that we could have both room for cars and also room for our bikes and the people who want to walk to get where they want to go.
You were Secretary of Planning for the state of Maryland under Governor Paris Clendenning. You decided as Secretary of Planning that there had to be a better way. Tell me what you did differently to change the patterns of development in Maryland's communities.
The real epiphany in Maryland was that even though you think about development really happening at the local level, which of course it does, but so many of the rules of the game and so many of the infrastructure investments that dictate where development will eventually go, like where a highway goes or whether or not you're going to have transit, are often decisions that are made at the state level. And so in Maryland, we recognize that we could help shape where growth would go by our own investments. And so what we decided to do was to use the state budget as an incentive to encourage growth in existing communities, and not so much in the far-flung exurbs and on farmland that had never been developed. So we used our state dollars for transportation, for water and sewer, for school construction, economic development, et cetera, to direct growth to our existing communities for the most part and to other places, new communities, where local government determined that growth would be going.
What were the advantages to the state in directing development to existing communities?
Well, there were three things, really. The pattern of development over the last few decades has been this kind of gradual spread out from the center, often accompanied by a disinvestment or even an abandonment of our older neighborhoods. So one of the advantages of this policy is that it would invest in existing communities where people are already living, where we already have a lot of infrastructure, where we already have a lot of the buildings and the civic institutions and the urban form in many cases that really can't be replicated. And it's efficient to develop in that way and to serve every new job and every new household that might be coming to the state using that existing infrastructure. So that was a big part of it. And it also meant that the state that had a fairly ambitious farmland and open space preservation program, that the state wasn't kind of losing out on those open space investments, because by directing more growth to existing communities, we took some of the development pressure off those farmlands and those wonderful open spaces.
Who opposed you?
Well, initially, there was I would say there was quite a bit of opposition, and the development community was quite concerned, as were the county governments. But in fact, as the program took shape, you know, we basically let local governments determine where growth would occur, because Maryland, like many places, is definitely a growing place. So new growth was coming. It didn't make sense that every bit of it would go into existing neighborhoods and existing communities, nor would those existing neighborhoods all necessarily welcome a lot of new growth. But rather than having it go kind of willy-nilly over the entire state, including those places that we'd actually designated and the counties had designated for conservation, we said, this is what your population growth is projected to be for the next 20 years. Why don't you decide where it makes most the most sense to go? And we'll follow your blueprint for our investments, but we're not going to invest in those places that you've not designated for growth according to your population projections. And so the counties, you know, eventually came around to this idea, and the municipal governments, of course, were always in favor of it. The development community remained, I think, kind of suspicious and concerned for several years until we actually started being a lot more active, trying to help their best developments take place, actually becoming advocates for good development in those places where it's honestly the hardest to grow. It's not enough, I think, for the state to say, gee, we'd really like the growth to go here. We discovered we really had to be a lot more involved, because, in fact, even if you were going to leave it simply up to the private sector and let the free market determine where growth would go according to the current regulations in many places, those existing communities just aren't favored for growth because it's so much more expensive to grow there. The land is more expensive to assemble the parcels, which are often very small and have had maybe decades, maybe generations upon generations of ownership by different folks, so they might have a very unclear title. You know, a lot of factors that make it a lot more expensive to develop in those existing neighborhoods. So we really had to do more to help level the playing field for those increasing numbers of developers who said, you know what, we think there really is a market for development in those existing neighborhoods, and we'd like to be back there if we can find a way to not lose our shirts by doing so.
If you look back on the cost of developing, of leveling the playing field, if you will, to develop on existing infrastructure, and the public cost of investing or of supporting investment in the exurbs, where did you calculate that the state of Maryland came out in its decision to push development toward existing infrastructure?
I have to say that it's not, you know, this isn't a calculation that would hold true for every single instance, but in general, you know, the capital cost of providing the roads, the water lines, the sewer lines, all of the other infrastructure is considerable for a couple of reasons, because that new development is often, that exurban development is often pretty far away from existing communities from the center. It's also a lot lower density, so you're using a lot more pavement to serve the same number of households or the same number of jobs. And the other cost that continues to be borne year after year is that it takes a lot more resources to actually serve those households. So not only the capital costs, but sort of the operation and the maintenance costs are higher for that lower density, more spread out form of development. Now, it's not always true that you can use the existing infrastructure in an older neighborhood exactly as is. Sometimes it needs some upgrades, but even so, the fact that the distances are a lot shorter, that often you have a lot more intensity of use, both residential, commercial, and retail, kind of all together, along with civic uses, means that even if you have to invest in some infrastructure upgrades, that it's often a lot more economical to serve, for the public to serve that new development in an existing neighborhood than in a far-flung, very spread-out community that's far from the center.
The calculation you described generally makes sense, but did you ever do the numbers?
You know, we didn't do the numbers specifically for the state of Maryland. We relied a lot on research that was done by Bob Rochelle at Rutgers and by a number of other researchers around the country. Although in specific instances, we did do an analysis about where a state location decision, because we have a lot of state facilities, where that kind of siting might go. And in some cases, we looked beyond merely the cost to the state, but also looking at the cost to the consumer, the user of the state facility. We had a human resources service center in one of our smaller towns in Maryland, and the original plan was to vacate a building that had become somewhat dilapidated and build a new facility, and the cheapest land was actually out at the airport. But we did an analysis of the Department of Planning that showed that, in fact, almost none of the users of these social services actually lived anywhere near the airport. All of them would be required to find some pretty arduous way to get to this new social services building since the public transportation wasn't there. And if we were to find another site in town, which we eventually did, all of the users of those social services would be able to get there by existing public transportation or on foot. And so it was sort of shocking that that kind of analysis wasn't routinely done, at least in Maryland. But when we did it, we found that it really didn't make any sense to move that building in terms of the actual purpose of the activity that went on inside it.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Harriet Tregoning. She is Executive Director of the Smart Growth Leadership Institute, which was just awarded by the National Endowment for the Arts a contract to run a new program called the Governor's Institute on Community Design. Tell me about the program, Harriet.
It's a program that's modeled in part on a very successful National Endowment for the Arts program called the Mayor's Institute on City Design, which, Carol, I think you know something about. And the Mayor's Institute obviously works with the chief executives of cities and towns across the country. The Governor's Institute is aimed at those state chief executives who currently probably don't think of themselves as the chief designer of what happens in their state. But in fact, so many of their decisions really influence placemaking that we think many of them are going to be very interested in the new Governor's Institute, and we've been actually very gratified that in the first few weeks of our existence, we've been contacted by more than a dozen governor's offices.
How does a governor, in fact, influence community design? You've mentioned at least one way, and that is deciding on where highways will get built. What else?
You know, there's so many ways that governors can be influential. I mean, there's so many things about state laws that really establish the rules of the game for development. And a governor can do a lot with respect to, for example, housing affordability, with respect to whether citizens have transportation choices. Governors can help determine, you know, how state resources for parks and for recreation are going to be used, where conservation dollars are going to go, where farmland preservation dollars are going to go, and make sure that it all works together to create really terrific quality of life in a state. In addition to those really important transportation investments, because those can be very considerable, they can decide that when they build a road, they're going to make sure that every road has a good wide sidewalk that people can use, that there's a bike lane. They can make sure that the transit facilities are attractive and well-maintained and well-used. Their policies about school siting and university siting and expansion can make a really big difference about the quality of life in a place and whether or not it's going to continue to be attractive for households, for families, for businesses to want to invest in that area.
What are the trends in terms of state provision for schools? I know that in some cases, these very large campuses we were getting with high schools, for instance, was at least in part dictated by the amount of land that had to be available for any single school. Where is that headed now?
Well, you know, it's very funny, like how something becomes the conventional wisdom. I think for a long time we were sort of on a bigger is better and more efficient track with respect to a lot of different sorts of facilities, schools among them. So these mega schools, these enormous high schools, these enormous middle schools were very much the trend, with the notion that it would be much more efficient to serve a lot of students at a single facility. But for a lot of reasons, not merely the land constraints, because if you need a really, really big campus, that might tell you, well, you can't possibly be in the center of a neighborhood, particularly an existing neighborhood. You're going to have to go out to the edge to find the land for that facility. But it's also true that sometimes these really large schools aren't so good for all the students in those schools. So many, many places are looking at revising their school siting and school sizing policies, you know, including the governor of South Carolina, who recently made a decision to sort of set aside the siting standards that really dictated that all new schools would have to be on a very large acreage instead of allowing neighborhood schools to be built.
Is there a downside to smart growth? Does anyone lose in this proposition?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people believe they're going to lose. You know, it's certainly true that in many neighborhoods, you know, mine among them, that what developers promised would happen and what the government promised would happen in terms of a change for the better wasn't always a change for the better. And you can look at what happened with our interstate highway system and how it divided so many of our cities as one example of that. But urban renewal is another example of that. But I think that if you're a for-profit developer, smart growth in many cases is about making it much easier to develop where it's traditionally been very difficult to develop. And it's about meeting market demand that in many, many places hasn't been met for decades. And with our changing demographics, with our changing lifestyles, with our aging population, you know, there's really a demand for so much more choice in housing, you know, and so many more vital communities that, like I say, if you're a for-profit developer, there's a lot of opportunity, you know, for you out there. And I think that we've gotten so much more sophisticated and we pay so much more attention to the quality of life in a community and making sure that communities have a say in what's going to happen there. And so both on the public sector side and the private sector side, I think people are paying a lot more attention to what communities want and actually seeking out the views of neighborhoods and neighborhood groups when deciding about what the future is going to be in that place.
It seems like there is a lot of momentum around smart growth. I'm sure you feel like the Smart Growth Leadership Institute has had something to do with that, as well as Smart Growth America. But do you think there's been a particular trigger point that has rallied citizens to this cause?
I think it's a little bit the thing that I was talking about, that if you ask people what they want in their neighborhoods, no one's going to say, I want a bigger road with faster traffic moving through my neighborhood. I want stores that I can't get to, you know, that I want development that's going to cut me off from my neighbors and, you know, make it less convenient for me. So I think that we're finally getting smarter about asking ourselves, what is the kind of place we want to live in and why can't we create it? Americans travel so much now. They go all across the country. They go by plane. They go by train. They drive. And they visit these wonderful communities all around the country and in many other countries. Some people travel to Europe and they travel to Canada. And the places they like to visit are these places where you can sit outside at a cafe and have a cup of coffee or, you know, have a drink in the evening or have a nice dinner, where you can walk. You can have things to see and do without having to be always on the interstate. And I think people are starting to realize, you know, this isn't just a place I could visit. I could live in a place like this. My community could be a place like this, and why not? So, you know, I think that's an enormous thing, that people realize they can help shape their community for the better, and that developers are realizing that there's a market for that kind of place, that Americans want to live fit and healthy until they're in their dotage, right, as long as they possibly can. And that means they have to be in places where it's easy to be physically active, where they don't have to make an appointment or get in their car for half an hour in order to exercise for half an hour. So people want to be in places where they can be active as part of their daily life. And I think another part of it is that, you know, the economics of this development pattern, you know, are really beginning to wear on some places and on some households.
As you describe that vision, what is the biggest factor standing in the way of achieving that vision you describe?
Well, even when everyone agrees that that's what they want, right? And it's not every place where that agreement takes place, but even when everyone seems to agree, yeah, we'd like to grow in a different way, pretty much every single rule and regulation that's in place in that community probably prohibits it. It's pretty daunting how many things have to change. I mean, I don't think it was intentional, but the development pattern that we currently have, this kind of sprawling pattern of growth, we have it at this point because it's become a system, you know, that produces automatically, efficiently, without any intervention, the sprawl. And if you want to do something different, you know, you basically have to rewrite most of the rules. And that means the rules for financing. That means the codes and the zoning, the subdivision regulation, the road standards, the school siding regulations. I mean, I could really go on and on. So it's, you know, it means having to make a lot of changes. The good news is you don't have to change everything to be able to get started. And a lot of communities have figured out ways to create an alternative that doesn't change the underlying rules, but basically says this other way of growing is also an option. You could develop in this way, and as soon as a couple of projects get built and people can see how nice it is, then it's a lot easier to change those underlying rules.
Where has the most progress been made? Where can people look to the model?
I mean, increasingly, there are places in many, many cities. I mean, at this point, almost too numerous to mention. But think of those cities that you do like to visit. Charleston, South Carolina, like Washington, D.C. I mean, Washington, D.C. has undergone an incredible renaissance in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, we were pulling almost no new building permits in the mid-90s, in the early and mid-90s. And now it's unbelievable how many new apartment buildings, how many new houses, how many new commercial buildings, just how much more activity there is on streets and in neighborhoods that really hadn't seen much new investment in decades. A lot of that has to do with a really great transit system that we have in the Washington region. And it's no surprise that all across the country, people are starting to pass transit initiatives. A big one passed in Colorado in the Denver region recently. And, you know, many other places in the West are absolutely looking at transit as a part of their transportation future. So I think whatever state you're in, whatever city you're in, you don't have to look too far to find an example of this this new kind of development that mixes uses, that gives people more choices in housing and transportation. And I encourage people to find those places, go and hang out in those neighborhoods and see how it feels and see what you have to do to bring more of that development to your city and town.
Harriet, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Harriet Tregoning is Executive Director of the Smart Growth Leadership Institute, which will run the Governor's Institute on Community Design, a new program of the NEA. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his personal view of life in cities.
The Augusta Canal runs a parallel track to a stretch of the Savannah River, from which it borrows its flow to make its way through the river town of Augusta, Georgia. The Savannah River is the border between South Carolina and Georgia. In the 19th century, the small rapids around Augusta kept commercial boat traffic from reaching town. So between 1845 and 1850, the Augusta Canal was built to bypass these rapids. The canal transformed Augusta, attracting textile mills and iron works. The assurance of power and transportation persuaded the government of the Confederate States of America to locate the Confederate Powder Works in Augusta. After the Civil War, the Augusta Canal continued to attract industry and investors, enabling Augusta to sidestep much of the post-war hardship that plagued the rest of the South. Hydroelectric power from the falling water of the canal powered electric streetcars and streetlights in Augusta, the first city in the South to enjoy these modern amenities. Eventually, though, time took its toll on the canal. Despite extensive repairs to fix the damage caused by major floods in the 20s and 30s, the canal eventually fell into disrepair as textile mills closed and industrial growth moved to other parts of the city and the region. By the 1960s, the canal was so run down that city planners considered draining it and using the dry bed for a major highway. Interest in the canal began to revive in the 70s and 80s. In 1989, the state legislature created the Augusta Canal Authority, which, in 1993, completed a master plan for redevelopment. In 1996, the U.S. Congress designated the Augusta Canal as one of America's National Heritage Areas. Today, the levees and spillways of the upper portion of the old Augusta Canal form an 8.5-mile-long public park filled with walkways, bicycle paths, and picnic shelters that are used for everything from church cookouts to private weddings. Kayakers and canoeists paddle the peaceful waters of the canal itself. Recently, my friend Max and I, along with our wives, spent one bright weekend morning paddling the length of the canal. Our paddle took us through a place of pure tranquility and repose, which I did not expect. The canal borders the city and is crossed at one point by I-20. Yet between its banks, the Augusta Canal is a pocket of serenity. As we dreamily floated the canal, we saw a teeming diversity of wildlife. Flowering plants of every color, as well as river otters, herons, and a surfeit of sunning turtles. Perhaps it reflects our schizophrenic nature that a slice of wilderness can be so easily reclaimed right next door to our civilized cities and streets. It is certainly ironic that an artificial waterway built for industry and commerce is now an escape from these very things. But it is encouraging, too. For it means that we still care about a balanced way of life, even if we can't or won't live that way often enough. It is, at least, a start. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter with information about our guests. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.